and the WLRN app.
91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today marks 25 years since Hurricane Andrew blew into the lives of South Floridians. What a memorable experience for many, including this hour's guest, meteorologist Brian Norcross. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Norcross spent 22 straight hours on the air at WTVJ Channel 4. He broadcast huddled in a storage closet as the great storm's deadly eye made landfall. We'll hear how this storm, Andrew, affected Brian Norcross, his reflections on tough decisions, the mistakes made in covering it, and how it influenced his career. And it cost him. His voice still bears a bit of a rasp. Brian Norcross has written a memoir about it, My Hurricane Andrew. He'll join us in minutes after the news. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, it's Thursday's Topical Currents. This hour we visit with acclaimed meteorologist and the Weather Channel's senior hurricane specialist, Brian Norcross.
He's back on our program to tell his unique story of Hurricane Andrew on the 25th anniversary of the storm's South Florida landfall. It's a time to remember, for it's a signature event in our region's history.
In all, 65 people died from the Cat 5 Andrew. 44 in Florida. Some were caused indirectly, of course. Property loss and damage was exorbitant, in the area of $26 billion. Now Brian Norcross has written a memoir of the storm.
It's called My Hurricane Andrew Story, Preparation, Terror, and Resilience by the Man Who Talked South Florida Through the Great Hurricane of 1992. Welcome back, Brian.
Thank you, Bonnie. Thank you, Joe.
So we're going to get to the book, which is so important, in just a second, but let's get an update. Give us the lowdown on Harvey, if you can.
It's all bad, potentially very bad for the Texas coast. The storm is strengthening more quickly than even forecast. So it's forecast now to be a Category 3. It would not be surprising to see it be a Category 4 by the time it reaches the coast.
Now, just this morning, they were saying if it hits, it's going to be a 1. What happened?
Well, of the various aspects of hurricane forecasts, the intensity is the least well understood and the least well predicted. So, as a matter of fact, going back 25 years,
right,
we don't do it a whole lot better than we did then. There's only been very gradual improvement. We're much, much better now than in 1992 on where the storm is going, but not on how strong it's going to be. So the atmospheric ingredients just came together there in the western Gulf of Mexico. It's very much like Andrew coming over the Gulf Stream approaching South Florida and having that additional fuel. There happens to be a pool of deep, warm water right in the way of Harvey, and so it's taking advantage of that and favorable atmospheric conditions. But on the Texas coast, there are big parts of the Texas coast that really next to nobody lives. So if it goes north of Corpus Christi, there's a chance that the wind will not be the issue. The problem is that it's forecast to move just ashore and then drift and stall. Mm-hmm. And you have the hill country back in San Antonio and up in Austin, which aggravates the rain problem, and they have a long history of devastating floods there where the rivers fill. And so that entire East Texas area has multiple threats, including 2 feet or more of rain and a storm surge and this persistent problem lasting into next week.
I've read about the 1900 Galveston storm, just a deplorable situation there.
It was. Well, that happened to hit the most populated place on the coast in Texas at that time, which was Galveston.
With little warning for the Texans.
Right, and a lack of understanding. The people in Galveston asked the Weather Bureau people at the time, should we put up a seawall? And they were told, no, don't. We're never going to get that kind of a storm that you're going to need it here. Well, after the fact, they actually raised the city and put a seawall there to protect the old part of Galveston. Now, in the way the world changes, People have built south there outside of the seawall. So a large part of Galveston is not protected and is very, very vulnerable to storm surge, which, of course, they got in Ike in 2008.
All right, let's get to the book. So it's been 25 years ago today. In the way that Andrew still strikes terror in our hearts, I really feel it could have been yesterday. So congratulations on the book. I realized, you know, we've heard hundreds and hundreds of stories from those who braved the storm, but we've never heard your story. Why did you decide to do it now?
Well, I decided that the 25th anniversary was a lot better than the 26th anniversary to to tell the story. But also, my sense is, you know, I work at the Weather Channel. I work with a tremendous number of talented meteorologists, and I work with schools, and I meet young people studying weather very enthusiastically and academically, real brilliant. And what I've found is that Andrew is on the list of terrible old hurricanes, right? But there are so many things that we can learn from Hurricane Andrew, because no storm was more measured up to that time scientifically. And it also hit this very populated area. So we don't have much experience with hurricanes hitting high population centers, really intense hurricanes hitting high population centers. In fact, the only thing comparable is Katrina, which was a whole different kind of disaster, which was really an engineering disaster. But still, it was this very human disaster. But that's the only one comparable. All these other storms that are terribly devastating don't have the extreme social problem of dealing with hundreds of thousands of people that are stranded in the disaster zone without the means to take care of themselves. And how do we deal with that problem? Andrew is really the example of that. Katrina has kind of a twist on it. So I just thought that story needs to be told. People need to understand that reality, that all these hurricanes that hit relatively unpopulated areas and devastate them, even Hurricane Sandy, which obviously hit kind of New York City with the coastline. You know, people in Midtown Manhattan were sitting at cafes the day
sipping their cappuccino.
Right, the day that Sandy happened. So that's not an example of a debilitated region where everybody is on their own and we just don't have the resources to deal with all those people. And we need to think about that. We need to, you know, that's part of planning. So I wanted to be sure that people understood what happened in Andrew, what an extreme situation it was, both meteorologically and in the aftermath. And, you know, with the hope that people that do hurricane planning keep that in the front of their mind.
Reading your book, I was really struck by the prescience that was involved, that you really had it and worked for over 2 years with Channel 4 to get your act together, and you really did.
It was this bizarre confluence of events ahead of the storm. In the 1980s, I worked at Channel 10 at WPLG here and did something called Neighborhood Weather. And Neighborhood Weather was an on-location segment every day where I came up with a story every day. I produced a live feature every day. So I'd have to research those. Well, this was before the internet, obviously. And so that evolved into my going to the History Museum downtown Miami, History Miami Today, and spending days and days and days in the research room there, going through folders and looking for pictures of locations where things happened. They weren't all hurricanes, but many of them were related to the hurricanes that have hit South Florida. In the first seven decades of the 20th century, we had a hurricane here every decade that was significant and damaging. Every single one, at least one. In some decades, multiple hurricanes.
26, 35, 28.
Right. 20. Yeah. But the things, the ones that we don't talk about, 29, right? We don't talk about the 1948 hurricanes. We talk about 47 in Broward and 40. We don't even really talk about 45, but there was one in 41, too. So they're all kind of hurricanes. There were two in 35, one in the Keys and one that hit downtown Miami. So we just don't talk about them. But anyway, so that got me interested in hurricanes. And that got me thinking, geez, if I'm ever chief meteorologist, everybody's going to look at me and say, what do we do now? If one of these storms comes along, like used to come along all the time. And then WTVJ hired me as chief meteorologist, and they bought into the plan of let's be the hurricane station and let's plan for it and let's look at our systems and say, what do we have to do to be sure that we can operate?
And a lot of it was just chance. I mean, thank God you did all that, because, I mean, so many people owe their lives to the fact that you were able to tell them what to do.
There were so many things that came together, including, you know, the people remember the bunker, right? When we moved to the bunker, because
that was an interesting thing. Okay, go ahead. So that
triggered so many people to go, oh crap, he must be serious.
If they got to get out, I better get out.
Right, exactly.
Right, but and I was thinking, you know, when that idea came to me, you know, this is a good thing, because here we are on a shiny news desk and we're telling people to leave their living rooms and go in a hallway, right? Well, it was just chance that right off of the anchor desk, there was this storage room that happened to be under the stairs that went up to the mezzanine of the Capitol Theater, which is what that WTVJ building was when it was built in the 1920s. Right? So there happened to be something that worked perfectly for a bunker right there. If it hadn't been there, you know, we probably would not have left the site.
That probably saved some lives.
I think so. There. I think so, because I've heard from, hundreds, thousands of people, who said that was the moment that they got up from where they were and went in into the hallway or into the closet or into the bathroom.
But I didn't know till I read the book, and I guess none of us would have known, wouldn't have been possible to know, that you did that not because of your being afraid that TVJ was going to be hit, but because you wanted people to take your lead and you were demonstrating that you have to do this.
Yeah, well, the initial thought was, what happened was I saw on the radar that there was this ultra-intense cell, a stronger cell than I'd ever seen show up on the radar in a tropical system on the north side, and I said, well, might that affect downtown Miami? Because I was confident by that time that the worst of it was going to be south of downtown. And I started looking up at the roof of this old building, you know, WTVJ building. I thought, geez, I don't know. Well, should we stay here? But then that evolved quickly into, you know, no, we shouldn't, because our moving is the thing we need for everybody else.
All right, we're going to take a short break, and we're going to go back to the Thursday, that's where I'd like to start, before Andrew, with Brian Norcross. He is an acclaimed meteorologist and the senior hurricane specialist at the Weather Channel. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It's today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Byrne, and, of course, the Weather Channel's Brian Norcross.
And we're discussing Brian's book. It's called Hurricane Andrew, My Story, Hurricane Andrew, Preparation, Terror, and Resilience. I want to add here that this is more than Brian's story. This is a manual for dealing with every aspect of a major hurricane. And I just want to put my two cents in. It's an important addition to what you need for your preparation, for your hurricane prep kit, okay? Okay, so, Brian, we talked about Harvey and how I said, oh, no, I heard this morning it's going to hit as a 1. You're saying it's 3, maybe a 4. So Hurricane Andrew, people forget, it was this nothing storm that nobody was paying attention to, but you were.
Well, yeah.
Even on the Thursday.
Well, I was paying attention to it, but honestly, on that Thursday or even that Friday morning.
Friday morning.
I was getting more interested on Friday morning, but by that Thursday, I wasn't really concerned. I mean, I was watching it, and because the day before, I actually had premiered the graphic that sort of evolved into the cone that we see today. So I was, you know, but my thought was that it was likely not a threat for us. That I thought, okay, this could be a threat for Florida, but most likely Central Florida, North Florida, something like that. But, you know, if you do these things right, it's not over till it's over, right? You don't ever get in your mind, okay, it's not a threat for us and we can go about our business and not worry about it. And so, but on Thursday, this was an extremely difficult situation and would be today again, because 4 days before landfall, it actually had no circulation. And so it actually technically should have been downgraded and have the name taken off of it, downgraded just a tropical disturbance. And so it was done just, you know, it was just this different kind of storm that we're really not used to. We're used to talking about them and being overhyped 10 days in advance, right?
Right.
And so this one, even today, would not be like that because it was such a fast-developing storm.
It's amazing to think that a small wisp of air in the desert Africa, what effect it has on so many lives, and especially yours, just that that small wisp of air that began to circulate just a little
bit. Is it air or dust?
No, it's air. It's a circulation in the atmosphere that starts over land and then generally kind of falls apart as it goes over the water and takes on a different characteristic. But it takes just the right atmospheric conditions to come together. So the right atmospheric conditions did not come together for Hurricane Andrew until Saturday or overnight, Friday night into Saturday. So 5 o'clock Saturday morning was the first time it was a hurricane, 75-mile-an-hour hurricane. 36 hours later, it hit the Bahamas as a 170-mile-an-hour hurricane. So it increased 95 miles an hour in 36 hours. And then 12 hours after that, it hit South Dade.
But at 3:15 on Friday afternoon, the National Hurricane Center and you had some very different ideas about this storm. What did you see? And because given the limitations and the resources, the equipment, including the computers that you were dealing with, you did that semi-cone thing with little lines. Little lines,
right.
But take us back. There was no internet. And talk about those limitations and why you had a different take on it than the National Hurricane Center.
Well, the spaghetti plots that we're all very familiar with today were only available to the forecasters of the National Hurricane Center. And so they did a lot of research, as they do today, on which models that they're looking at are the best models. Well, it turns out that the best models that they could see kept the storm well offshore and kind of northeast of the Bahamas into early week. Well, I couldn't see them, but what I could see was what's called a general circulation model or a global model that shows basically where the high and low pressure systems are and where were their forecast to be. And when that afternoon, that Friday afternoon, the map came in and I saw that this large high pressure system was indeed forecast to strengthen over North Carolina and to the north of Florida, I thought, if that happens, that's blocking the storm. Not only that, it could accelerate the storm toward the coast. So that's a threat to Florida, not necessarily even to South Florida, but to Florida for sure. And it's Friday. Well, in 1992, with no cell phones, you treat the weekend differently because people would go off on their boat, they'd go to the Keys, they'd go wherever they were going to go, and not really pay so much attention. People tended to tune out more without having all the news in their pocket on the cell phone. So I said, we need to raise the flag on this and be sure people know that there's a possibility, just a possibility, that over the weekend we have to start preparing for a storm that could be here as early as Monday. I honestly didn't think it was coming. And if it had not been Friday, if it had been Thursday, I probably wouldn't have done it. But my concern was that there was a risk, based on the information I had access to, that we could have this storm to deal with. And since it was Friday, I needed to talk about it. I have to hasten to add that none of that made any difference in the end. Everybody was on board by Saturday. Most people didn't even find out about it until Saturday. Sunday was the preparation day. And by Sunday evening, nobody was on the road. Everybody was prepared. But, of course, nobody really prepared because they had no idea what was coming.
Now, to further complicate things, where this is your part of Hurricane Andrew, you were in the middle, right in the middle of transitioning into a new job.
although I must say that entered into it on the front end, where I was supposed to actually not be in the office Thursday. I was supposed to, Wednesday was supposed to be my last day. Then I was going to go to North Carolina for the weekend and then Sunday go to New York to finalize a job in New York that following Monday. And my boss came to me on Wednesday and said, so what are you going to do? Because she knew what I was planning. I said, well, I'm going to stay and see what happens. I really can't go. We'll see what happens tomorrow. And and maybe I'll, you know, maybe I'll go on Friday. And then, you know, one thing led to another, and obviously I never went. And to add to that, my replacement was flying in Monday morning for his interview or for, you know, because he hadn't been to the station. But anyway, he was scheduled to be there that Monday.
You know, the other thing I loved about the book is the human side of that it shows of you, because in many times when you're taking us, because you have that sort of diary taking us through, you know, up until it hit, and then, of course, in the aftermath, everything that happened in the aftermath. But you take these timeouts and you go, you know, off on other things. You tell us that you grappled with your role as a TV weatherman, the tone you should take, whether or not to give life-saving advice. Just talk about that, all those questions that you had.
Well, I thought about this going back, as I said, to the 80s when the question really formed in my mind of what would I do, you know, if one of these incredible hurricanes like we used to have all the time came along. And, you know, one of the, as I thought about, okay, you know, obviously I'd like to help people through it and like to advise them. The question is, suppose you give them advice, and even though the advice was technically right because it gave them better odds, but you can't absolutely predict that they're not going to come to harm if they do what you say or if they don't do what you say. You know, I mean, sometimes you just can't predict that. And so is it the role of the TV weatherman to do that, or should that be the government's role, for example?
Right.
And so I wrestled with that quite a bit.
And then, you know, you were instrumental in so many decisions that night, even lifting the tolls on, I forget which,
on
the turnpike. No one was doing it. And you said, get with the program, lift the tolls, and then the boat falls off, you know, on MacArthur Causeway and is blocking people from evacuating. And you say, get out there, you know, and move the thing. But the sentence that really got me, you said your conclusion was nobody was going to lead, no agency, not any person, nobody. How did that make you feel to see that nobody was taking charge?
Well, I'd spent 2.5 years going all around South Florida, meeting with everybody I knew to meet with, from the Hurricane Center of Emergency Management, the school board, and the Coast Guard, and just everybody in all three counties, Dade, Broward, and Monroe counties. And, you know, I put in my mind how television coverage of a storm was going to come together, and I couldn't imagine, of the very responsible and dedicated people that I'd met with, how the system was ever going to gel so that someone had broad knowledge of the you know, what you do, how are we going to get through this? It just hadn't, you know, the system didn't work that way at that time. So, I mean, I've been in broadcasting at that time. I'd been in broadcasting for a long time. I'll be in broadcasting 50 years here coming in June of next year. So I could, you know, I could picture in my mind how it has to work for broadcasting to work. And I was pretty sure that nobody was going to step up, and I was right in the end.
There's such a fine line that you had to walk of, you can't be overly dramatic, and yet you can't not emphasize the importance of what to do. And sometimes the public thinks that, oh, they're just kind of grandstanding. There's that ubiquitous shot of a reporter at 45-degree angles and screaming over the microphone, and that you can't instill too much fear, but then again, you have to think of their safety.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, you know, my sort of mantra to myself was, just be straightforward. Don't overtalk it, but make the point over and over again. Whatever seems like the right direction, because we didn't know that it was going to be this absolutely off the charts hellacious thing when even Sunday morning started.
Right.
You know, we thought
it was that gorgeous sunny day.
That it was going to be a bad hurricane, which you very often get gorgeous sunny days ahead of bad hurricanes. We thought that, but not that it was going to be this, you know, cataclysmic hurricane. So as it evolved, I just resolved to try and take it one step at a time and not predict too far in advance what what we were going to get until I was sure that's what we were going to get.
And the exact point of that is that many people early on thought that Broward would be the point of mm-hmm. impact, and people went from Broward right into the eye
right.
by traveling to South Dade to relatives and things.
Yeah, well, people that left the coastline in Broward and went to Kendall did the right thing.
Okay.
Obviously, they wish they hadn't done that.
Unless they went the country
because, walk. Because even today, we could not tell South Florida whether the worst of a hurricane coming from the east is going to hit Miami or Fort Lauderdale one day out.
You just don't know.
The science is not refined enough to
Still.
Do that. So the flaw in many of those decisions was to ask the question, how strong is the house that I'm going to evacuate to? It wasn't whether I should evacuate. Those people indeed should have evacuated if they were leaving Hollywood Beach or Fort Lauderdale Beach or, you know, other areas near the water, because if the storm had come that far north, they may not have survived.
You haven't read this, so I'm going to read this to you. Mm-hmm. It was a great piece by Hal Bodeker in the Orlando Sentinel. And he quotes Al Tompkins of the Poynter Institute about you. He says he gave one of the great performances in local TV news history. He didn't scare people. He prepared people. Tompkins is saying this. Two things set him apart. He knew his community in an intimate way. He focused on preparation, not just how big and bad it was, but what, how and what you should be doing.
Yeah, that's a wonderful quote. Al Tompkins is a pro. I appreciate that. One of the things that I did, one of the decisions I made that made the broadcast in 1992 so different than the hurricane broadcast today, is I elected to not talk about the nuances of the meteorology and every flight of the hurricane hunters. You know, I kept that on a macro level. The question was whether it was the new information was made any difference in what our preparation was going to be.
Right.
We didn't know the millibars.
Right. I didn't worry about that. The question was, what is the level of the threat? And as the level of the threat got higher, we ramped up, you know, the level of concern, which led me to the question of, now that we've prepared for 2 days, you know, I started talking about it on Saturday, people really prepared for, let's say, a day, and they'd done everything, and now it's after midnight, Sunday night, and the storm is coming, and it's coming to South Dade. You know, I saw that this was going to be the extreme event, hopefully, of our lifetime, and I thought, what else could I do, and what else could people do in their homes after they've done everything that they could do? And that was where I remembered this book by L.F. Reardon from 1926, where he was with his family in Coral Gables, and the wind is whistling through the house, and they moved the kids and put them in laundry tubs with a mattress over the laundry tubs. And I thought, that's the thing that people can do after they've done everything else, is get a mattress off the bed. And so that's what I said, friends, here's what I want you to do. Get that mattress off the bed and go and get under that with your family and ride this out. And that turned out to be that, and the move to the bunker were the two smartest
yeah.
things I ever said or thought of in my life. And neither of them were part of my hurricane plan that I'd been thinking about for years.
You know, we talked a moment ago about no one did take charge. And if this were now, 25 years later, is there anyone that can take charge and do what wasn't being done 25 years ago?
I think it would be better, but I think in general the answer is no. I mean, what's happened in
and
South Florida...
There's more people,
and it's more complicated. And
more,
you know,
more buildings.
And Hurricane Andrew was relatively simple in that it was heading for South Dade. So there came a point where I quit worrying about high rises and worrying about Miami Beach and all these very complicated other problems that come into play when you get the dense core of the city, right? This was going to be mostly residential people. Now, Brickell had a lot of damage, which never got much publicity, but you know, this was so extreme and was heading for South Dade. So I concentrated on that. Well, what's evolved is in South Florida, you know, government emergency management, county emergency management is just so much better, so much more organized. And generally, the politicians become the spokespeople. Now, that's not ideal because, they don't spend their lives thinking about hurricanes, right? They get briefed and then go on TV and become the face of the information. And some politicians are good at it. Mayor Jimenez may or may not be good at it. I don't know. We don't, he doesn't have a lot of experience like we saw Mayor Pinellas, Alex Pinellas in the 90s. We had a whole, it became routine and he became outstanding at it. So that's the way it's evolved. That's certainly better than it was in 1992, is that there is a system for government telling us what, they're doing, what they're recommending, what services are available. Things like 311 and all these things are much more robust now than they were in 1992. I don't in any way think that we have a system that would work in a really big hurricane. I mean, other countries have teams in their national broadcast system within the BBC, within the NHK in Japan, that's what they do, is they plan for emergencies for emergency communications. And we don't have that in this country.
So what should we be doing? I mean, obviously, we need to do something.
Well,
may not have another Brian Norcross telling us what to do.
We should individually prepare ourselves and be, be savvy on our own. I mean, that really is the only real defense, because there's just no way to know at the time that the storm happens how it's going to come together, how well the communications are going to flow. The communication systems today are much more precarious than they were in 1992, because so many people, most people, don't have portable radios today.
And what about residential construction since 1992? Are we still possibly having a country walk kind of construction?
No, I think that is the real positive from 1992. The two big advancements.
And every year there's talk about lowering the code to state level instead of the county.
Brian brings that up, that legislators are trying to weaken the South Florida High Wind Code.
Well, they just passed a bill that has the potential of weakening the code all over the state of Florida. But so the two big positive steps, one is that emergency management is so much better organized and better funded, and not ideal. And after the recession, it really took multiple steps back at a local level in many places. But it is much, much better. The other is the building code in use in Miami-Dade and Broward counties is so drastically better because it fixed the inspection problem. And the country walk thing came about because of the inspection problem. If there were inspectors on the job, they never would have permitted those buildings to be built that way, right? And because it wasn't the code as much then as it was in country walk.
For those not familiar with, explain how country walk, if you saw an aerial shot of South Dade County,
right,
all the buildings around those subdivisions there did pretty well during the storm, and they were just leveled in country
right
walk.
Well, so the country walk homes collapsed. The buildings around were all damaged, and most of them were not inhabitable. But the country walk homes just weren't built to construction standards that were applicable to this climate. And they should not have been allowed. It really was a collapse of the inspection protocols. Well, that doesn't happen now. The people that live in homes that were built since 1995 or so, the odds are very, very high that the house will be inhabitable after the next storm, assuming if they have shutters that they put them up, that they do common sense things. Not that there won't be damage if Hurricane Andrew comes along, every building gets damaged, but that doesn't make them necessarily uninhabitable. So that's a tremendous improvement, but that's a fraction of the number of buildings in just these two counties, let alone Palm Beach County. And so in Palm Beach County, they initially adopted the Miami-Dade code. Then when the state of Florida got a code that was weaker than the Miami-Dade code for the whole state, they went to the state of Florida code. So it's not even certain when you get up to Palm Beach County that you have, you really need to ask somebody, how is this building that I'm in
Who
here?
Do you ask?
Well, there are, you know, architects and engineers and whatnot that can tell you. And very often your insurance company will tell you whether you meet Miami-Dade standards and what you would have to do to do that.
So you can still insist on that when you're buying a house?
Absolutely. It's the gold standard. I mean, all over the world, throughout the Caribbean, people talk about the Miami-Dade, you know, are those Miami-Dade shutters?
Hmm.
You know, yes or no. And it's all the information is available. If you look at the shutter, it's got a stamp on it. You look it up online and you see, yes, my shutter meets that criteria.
The idea that someone would want to weaken those on a statewide
basis. It's amazing.
What
can citizens do about that? Can they go talk to their legislators?
You know, everybody should talk to their state representatives and state senators and the governor and say, I'm appalled. You people are irresponsible. Because the building lobby has been trying to get the building codes weakened since 1992. It was a war to get the South Florida code.
Why? It's so much more expensive?
It's a pain in the neck to build a house under the new protocols, under the modern protocols. You have to have constant inspections. You're at the mercy of the building department. You know, nobody can prove to me that buildings can't successfully be built here and builders, you know, can't make money. I mean,
maybe you're still standing from 75 years.
There's a great photo in your book. It's the Deering Estate. And that, how thick were those walls Deering Mansion?
Yes, I know. The walls are feet thick. And that house was there, right on the bayfront at the 17-foot storm surge with waves on top of that. So the waves are crashing on the second floor of that building, and it stood there, and some roof tiles came off. Now, there was damage because the water went into the building.
But talk about the other house on the property.
Well, the other house on the property was built in 1899, and it was a wood structure, and it was obliterated. But the thing is, so was the Burger King headquarters next door, right, that was just not built to the standard. So the waves crashed on that, and, you know, the CEO's office washed over to Naples somewhere.
How about top speeds? At the National Hurricane Center, the anemometer failed because the winds were so high. Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
It was. Well, the Hurricane Center was in a 12-story building across from the University of Miami on South Dixie Highway. So the anemometer was like 150 feet up. So the higher you go above the ground, the stronger the winds, which is a lesson for high-rise buildings, by the way. The forces on the building at the higher levels are much greater than they are down near the ground, and the buildings are designed to take that into account. Well, the gusts that were recorded there were just unbelievable. I mean, when we got word, when the radar failed, so the radar was on top of that high-rise building, or mid-rise building by today's standards, and blew off the pedestal on the roof and smashed down on the roof, shook this 12-story building, scared everybody in there to death. And when that happened, we got a call in from the Hurricane Center on the phone, and we found out that the winds had gusted at that point up to 152 miles per hour. That was just after the radar failed. And they were still able to measure them. And I thought, wow, I mean, that's not even in the eye wall. So that was one of the things that clued me in that this was a stunning storm. It wasn't just a strong hurricane.
New residents, think of that, 155
well,
miles an hour.
You know, and that's what I think is important. And you just said we don't have transistors. Well, we do have the Eton Emergency Radio, which we do give away.
On a pledge drive.
On our pledge drives, we do offer, which does have. Mm-hmm. But talk about what you did with Y100 and how and why you were able to stay on the air, because that was a fluke too.
Yeah, well, that came about because in Hurricane Hugo in 1989, right outside of Charleston, all of the media went off the air. So those people that went through it there, unless they picked up a distant station or it was one AM daytimer that was in the suburbs that was able to stay on but really didn't have access to information while it was happening, they didn't have anybody there. So I was up in South Carolina after that, and that filtered into my brain when I was thinking about what do we need to do. So I started thinking, okay, we need a radio partner. And I went up to Y100 and made a deal with them and looked at their studio, which was on Sunrise Boulevard, right at the Intracoastal at that time. I said, well, this is no good, because if we have one of those hurricanes, like in 1926, this was deep underwater here, and a big hurricane, this is going to get evacuated. So we ran a dedicated line from downtown Miami to the Y100 transmitter, and then another line from there to the studio. Now, just thought, you know, that was on the very odd chance that nobody could be at the Y100 studio to do it. That line was tested 1 week before Andrew hit. On Monday the 17th, I got word from the engineer, okay, we've you know, talked to the Y100 engineers and we've tested it out and everything is good. I said, okay, great. And it just, you know, and just...
So they had a board and some microphones out there.
No, they didn't
could just
have
take
that.
take your signal.
They actually physically took the wire and somehow inserted it into the input of that transmitter. I mean, I don't know whether he used a little mixer or what he did to do it, but the Y100 engineer went out there on Sunday and took that wire from Bell South and connected it right into the transmitter.
Are they at the county line,
they're
too?
They're at the county line.
Like a lot of stations.
Right, yeah, inland, yeah.
All right, let's take our last break on topical currents. Meteorologist, hurricane specialist of the Weather Channel, Brian Norcross, on the 25th anniversary of Andrew, Hurricane Andrew. We'll be right back.
Good evening. Hurricane Andrew continues to move on its westward course toward southeast Florida. The eye of the hurricane is expected to cross the Miami area somewhere around 8 a.m. tomorrow morning.
This is Monday, August 24th, the Ford edition. Hurricane of our nightmares is knocking at the front door.
Well, right now I'm looking out the window and the wind is blowing pretty hard. Raining, lightning.
Oh, yes, we got lightning, and I mean, it sounds like, you know, freight trains going by the window.
Well, okay, we'll keep you company as long as we can stay on the air.
Riders on the storm.
Tough situation down in the Cutler Ridge area.
Riders on the storm.
The roofs are coming off the houses. The windows are blown in.
Into this house we're born.
Now, 165 miles an hour there.
Into this world we're thrown.
It's very scary, and I guess the worst of it is just coming, because it's really super quiet right now.
Riders on the storm.
I was so scared in the middle of my hallway.
Riders on the storm.
We hunkered down, my husband and I.
It's gone. I mean, we used to shop at the shopping center up the street. Here, there's nothing left.
We have our lives left. We're very fortunate. We're very fortunate.
The world on you depends, our life on...
I heard Sonny Fox in that.
Yes.
From the old days.
Heard Kelly Craig.
Yes.
Bob Sheets. Okay, so that version of Riders on the Storm by Jim Morrison, of course, in The Doors, was produced by our morning drive host, Joe Johnson. We cut off some of it a few days after Hurricane Andrew. At that time, Joe was creative services manager, Magic 102.7,
right exactly.
Which is now no longer. So I still, there's some important things still to cover. So we don't have transistors, but we do have Facebook, Twitter, and Google, and Instagram. Mm-hmm. Do you think that they could live up to or play an important role in... if there were to be an Andrew?
Yeah, I think they play a role, but they don't substitute at all for a robust communication system that can survive the storm. The mobile phone system.
A broadcast system.
Well, a cell can go down. These cell towers can go down.
It's not just that. We know that in every disaster, you cannot make a call. You can text even when the system is completely working, let alone... you know, what might happen in a mega hurricane, right, that would physically damage the
system. People are calling out. People are calling in. How are you doing? Waiting for the storm. So it's useless.
Well, yes. But so the little earthquake that we had in Washington, D.C. a few years ago, nobody could make a call on their cell phones. 9/11, nobody could call, even though the cell phone system was working, because... you know, when something bad happens, everybody wants to get on their phone, right?
Well, evidently, some people say, I think I heard recently that they're not even installing landlines anymore.
Right, right. Most places, or many places, I hesitate to say most, but I think most places, you can't get what is technically a real landline.
Hardwired.
Right? Hardwire, what's called a POTS line, plain old telephone service line, which is a wire that goes from your house to the phone company with nothing in between, so that it's not dependent on electricity. Most people that have home phones today have them through the cable company, and that's an electricity-dependent system. So that's not a reliable.
I got talked out of my hardwired phone last year, and I really regret it.
I didn't.
Well, there are many parts.
My building changed. I kept mine.
Well, there are many parts of South Florida that it's not available anymore,
yeah.
and phone companies they're losing money on that system. So maintaining that system is a big challenge for them. So I feel for them, but it really is a public safety problem. I remember being in South Dade, maybe in Country Walk, but in Kendall somewhere after Andrew, a few days after Andrew, end of the week. And I was at somebody's house, and everything was destroyed. But there was a Princess phone sitting in the backyard, and I picked it up, and there was a dial tone on that phone, even though all the poles were down, the wires were on the ground, and there was certainly no power anywhere for miles, but because it's such a robust system. So,
So what do we do about that?
You know, everybody gets a transistor radio, a portable transistor radio. That's such an old term. You know, my kids don't even know that word, right? It's a portable radio that runs on batteries, right?
Also, if the young people see a radio that's not digital display,
yeah.
What is that?
Right, and they aren't expensive. So that with plenty of batteries, and you need to have a communications plan, which generally means that you have an outside of the area person to connect with, to send a text to when you can get a call out, call outside of the area, because the odds are much, much higher that you can get a call out to somebody in New York or so anywhere else.
Or a text.
Or a text, but just much higher that you can get outbound than within, because both of you have to have access to working phone service in order to talk to somebody within the disaster zone.
You know, there's so many people I talk to that have never been through a hurricane. They're new to South Florida. Some people still get excited at the thought of going through a hurricane. What would you say? I'm sure there are some people, many listeners right now who have never been through a hurricane. What would you want to say?
Well, I want the people that haven't ever been through a hurricane, I don't think any of them think that we don't have hurricanes in South Florida. And it's up to you, if you're going to live here, to learn about hurricanes and what you need to do to protect yourself. There's a tremendous amount of information. I think the more difficult people are the people that went through Wilma, for example, or even Matthew.
Even
Matthew last year. Talking to people in Palm Beach County, for example, that, they got all geared up. They had evacuations in Palm Beach County in Matthew, and then nothing happened, right? So those kinds of people are the people that are much more difficult to move and react to the current storm, because they equate the current storm with the previous threat so easily, where they evacuated, it was a big pain in the neck, and they didn't end up needing to. And, and the message is that you're going to have to take full action, just totally prepare 4 or 5 times for every time that you actually need to have done it. And that's just part of living in coastal Florida. So if you want to live here, you get all the benefits. Well, that's a really annoying thing. And just get used to that and get on board with that, because you're risking your life and your family's life and everything by not getting on board with that. Be like moving to Michigan and saying, it's a pain in the neck to go buy winter coats. I'm not going to do it. It's just a stupid thing. Right, you gotta go with what Mother Nature gives you for where you live.
Well, that contributed in Andrew. I think we hadn't had anything. We had a brush with David in 1979, I believe, and that was about it.
Right. So that was an issue for sure. Although also in Andrew, nobody imagined what could happen. So even people that prepared and actually had shutters on their homes and so forth, Andrew exceeded those preparation capabilities.
Well, I think there's no substitute. I mean, it just makes me realize the importance of good broadcasting, exemplified by you, Brian, and good meteorologists and preparation. And again, I'm going to say that this book, the name of the book is My Hurricane Andrew Story, A Story of Preparation, Terror, and Resilience by the Man Who Talks South Florida Through the Great Hurricane of 1992. We're going to offer it during our upcoming pledge drive, by the way, signed copies, I hope. And there's no substitute for being prepared, and this book really is an incredible book to have in the compendium of your preparation kit. So Brian Norcross, he is, of course, an acclaimed meteorologist and the senior hurricane specialist at the Weather Channel. He received the 1993 David Brinkley Award for Excellence in Communication and is the recipient of an Emmy Award. He also has received DuPont and Peabody Awards, which are the highest awards given in broadcasting in the United States. And we thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Wonderful to be here.
Also, we failed to mention Linda Gastenheimer's Food and Dining returns next week. The 31st, we'll have a restaurant roundabout. Our lead producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction from Michael Stock. Polly Landis is associate producer. Peter Mertz provides this week's online content. And if you didn't catch the entire program or want to link it to others, it's easy to link a free audio archive from our website, WLRN.org. Also, check out the Topical Currents Facebook page and the iTunes podcast. And Bonnie and I return Monday, of course. We'll have a program with and about storytellers. You'll hear some fascinating ones from talented spoken word artists. Our theme music created by Michael Levine. Again, Linda Gastenheimer's Food and Dining returns next week, the 31st. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for Here and Now, next from NPR News.